Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are back with another episode of our show. And I'm looking forward to today's topic. It's actually one that has been it's close to my heart for a long time, based in where I am in Maryland. Of course, there are places way more rural than I am, and I sure have even more concerns than I have about rural EMS, but we'll get into that here in a second. Of course, we can't have any meaningful conversation on the show without our co-host, Sam Bradley. So, Sam, hey, how you doing?
Yeah, it seems like it's been a while, Jamie. I missed you guys, but moving is not the most fun thing I've ever done. And Mr. Kyle, our meteorologist, would like to know that I'm actually at the base of the Front Range. I mean, literally, I could walk to the nearest foothill. So I'm kind of curious on how that's going to affect the weather, because I think we're somewhat protected by those big hills. So, with no further ado, Mr. Kyle Nelson, meteorologist extraordinaire, what's going on?
Oh, Sam, thanks so much. And hello, everyone out there into the Disaster Podcast land. I'll tell you what, Sam, it's been a really active week of weather over the, especially in the Rockies, as we had two back-to-back winter storms rolling through, dropping a foot plus of snow across many of the mountain ranges in southwest Colorado, as well as into the central mountains as well. And being right up against the foothills there, it's both a blessing and a curse. If the wind's blowing from the west, you're going to do pretty good. You're going to stay warm and fairly dry. If it's blowing from the east, all that moisture is going to get squeezed out over those mountains, and you're going to get absolutely dumped on with rain or snow or maybe even a hailstorm come summertime. So look forward to that, I suppose. But looking ahead, though, from our conversation today here, just the Friday prior to Thanksgiving week, we're actually looking at a very active week of weather across the western U.S. and the upper Midwest for Thanksgiving week, specifically on many snowstorms coming in from the Pacific Northwest through the central Rockies, as well as some heavy rain and possibly even mixed in with some snow across Wisconsin and Michigan. So that's a quick coast-to-coast hit, Sam. Back to you.
I was wondering, is there anything else going on in the rest of the world that we might want to know about?
Well, Sam, weather-wise, you know, I do have to admit that I'm quickly just taking a quick look at the United States map here, actually just getting done with Ski Patrol Refresher Week for our medical things. So just quick hit 40 hours for that, just for me wrapping up here. So admittedly, I haven't had much time to look at the weather.
And actually, I can jump in. I mean, it's been a pretty quiet, you know, week or so worldwide for weather. I mean, we've got the, you know, the wildfires and issues going on down in Australia with their weather issues. But things up here and around the rest of the world seem to be pretty normal for this time of year, from what I can tell.
Well, hopefully the wildfires in California have settled down as well. That was getting quite nasty. We've been getting a lot of comments on that from the community, so we'll keep an eye on it. But tonight, we're going to talk about rural EMS. But before, I have to say, and I want to do this publicly, Mr. Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, is a new grandpa as of a few days ago. So we might have to start calling him Grandpa Jamie.
I actually am preferred. I'm going to go by Obi, so you can just talk Obi. All, you know, all you can all be my Padawans. So we'll leave it at that.
You got to tell us where that comes from.
Well, no, I'm a bit of a Star Wars nut, and a lot of my friends know that. So it was suggested that I should go by Obi-Wan, and I kind of thought, you know, Obi's not bad. And my wife is using the German grandmother term of Oma. So Oma and Obi kind of go together. So that's how it got started.
It does. You have to remember that. Well, on to our guest for tonight. Someone referred us in the community to this interesting article about rural EMS and some of the issues that were going on. And it so happens the man who was quoted in said article was a friend of Joe Hawley's, still is, I assume. So we have him here with us tonight. Andy Gienapp, who is a manager for the Office of Emergency Medical Services in Wyoming. which is just a spit up the road from me. So welcome, Andy. And tell us whatever else you want us to know about you.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on. I am just before we, as we were talking right before we got started, I am just right up the road from you. Appreciate the weather update because, man, you started talking about the Rockies and weather coming across, and it sounds like we're right in the path of some of that. So, but yeah, thanks so much for having me on. You mentioned Joe Holly. I've had the chance to work with him on a couple of different things over the years through different organizations and different boards. But yeah, I appreciate you showing interest in the topic. What would you like to know? Because I can talk for hours.
Well, good. That's easier on me. Well, you know, we've talked about rural EMS to some extent in the past, and we all know it's become more of a dire situation. But I think some of this was prefaced by an article, "What if you call 911 and no one comes?" So that's kind of where this all started. And you referenced the fact that it's not just rural EMS, it's all of EMS. How did we get into the situation we're in right now?
Sure. And I whenever I have the opportunity to talk about this, you know, I think it's helpful to go back to that and really understand things in a historical context and how we got there. Because I do think, even though we're going to talk specifically about rural America tonight, I do think that the elements of that put all of this into play in rural America are also the same factors with a bit of a different spin that are affecting EMS no matter where you are in the nation. So that's probably the first thing to get out, is to say, you know, how in the world did we end up where we are? And when I have the chance to talk about this in public, I say, this is the part of your EMT course or your paramedic course where we, you know, you probably spent the first night doing maybe an hour on EMS systems and EMS history, and somebody, your instructor, mentioned something about the white paper, and then you, in your mind as the EMT or paramedic, you were like, okay, let's get to the good stuff about how I intubate somebody. So for everybody that listens to the podcast, you know, I would say, you know, go dig that stuff out and look at the elements, because I want to point to some of that. But backing up from that, let me just tell you just a bit about myself. And, you know, I've been in the business now. I've been in EMS for, gosh, almost 30 years. That's really hard to believe. I did most of my EMS field work in the Chattanooga, Tennessee area, a little bit around in the Northwest Georgia and Pennsylvania areas, a little bit in Maryland. But the majority of my experience came out of Chattanooga. And what I tell folks is that in Hamilton County, which is the county that surrounds Chattanooga, it certainly has rural aspects to it. And I grew up in rural America between Eastern Iowa and Northeast Maryland, you know, and then moving in my teen years to Tennessee. But I have to be honest when I say that I really didn't understand it and I didn't get it until I took my job here in Wyoming. And I came out here and went, wow, this is an entirely different thing that's going on out here. And I don't think that most of us in EMS know it and understand it and have any concept about what's going on. And so I've tried to spend, as I've learned more and had the opportunity over the last 9 years, every opportunity I get to talk about this and try to raise awareness of it and get the word out, I've tried to take it. And so I really appreciate you folks having me on this podcast tonight. So which brings us back to the question, how did we get here? Well, without running through all of the boring historical details, I'll just hit the highlights and say and remind everyone that, first of all, EMS as a profession is still relatively young. Depending on what you figure the start date is, and generally we point to two things. One, it's either the 1966 white paper, Accidental Death and Disability, the Neglected Disease of Modern Society, or the other date that we tend to hang our hats on is the passage of the 1973 EMS Systems Act. So whichever date you choose and say, well, that was really the birth of modern EMS in the United States, it doesn't really matter because we're really only talking about 40-ish to maybe 50 years now that we've been around as an industry and been around as a service and available to the people of the United States. So that's not very long in the context of other professions that I'm sure many of you have seen those comparisons. It's not very long when you're comparing ourselves to the other public safety agencies like law enforcement and fire suppression, or even other healthcare professions, certainly like nursing and being a physician. We're really just a kind of a blip in the history of our nation. Number two, the other thing departments to understand about that is that not only are we young, but that youth in comparison means that we really haven't had time to evolve and think about it. If you look at the other professions that are out there and the other usual comparisons that get drawn, none of which are completely accurate in my opinion. You know, we have not had 100 years of evolution where we could really refine this and see our own professionals rise to the top and do consensus thinking and design elements and the rest of that. So we're still pretty new out of the primordial slime in terms of a profession and an industry. But so now you think, okay, so we're new, we're young, and we haven't really evolved, but what has happened? Well, here's what happened. When the idea of, well, there should be, it's not a great idea to leave people dying on the highways kind of dawned on all of us. And then we said, okay, well, somebody ought to do something about that. You know, that led us up at EMS Systems Act. And people are often surprised when I say to them, you know, you realize that EMS today was never supposed to be this way. No one ever envisioned us having the EMS that we have in place right now. In the 70s, early 70s, as they began that work on that, you know, they really envisioned somewhere between 300 and 400 EMS agencies across the entire nation. 300 and 400. Just let that sink in for a minute. 300 and 400 ambulance services handling the entirety of all of the EMS business that goes on today. You can look at any major urban area or any state even and go, wow, we have far exceeded those numbers. Even here in Wyoming, we're talking about 95 licensed ambulance services, both ground and air. I don't know the exact number, but you know, roughly the number I carry in my head that if you look at someplace like the Dallas-Fort Worth area, I think there was like 160 licensed ambulance services just in that one metro area. So we are way, way, way out of proportion of what was originally envisioned. How did that all come to be? It's because when we lost the motivation, that is the federal funding out of the 1980 Omnibus Reconciliation Act under the Reagan administration, when we lost that funding, then we seem to have lost the political will to do any planning or coordination, except that in our local communities, both urban and rural, we all felt compelled to continue to do something. And so what we had out of the 70s or 80s was a lot of folks who were well-intentioned, but nobody really knew what EMS was and what it should be. We just had some things that we thought were kind of good ideas, but none of that had been really tested. And so I think we're just now hitting that kind of stage in our evolution where we're starting to get some real science and some real thinking about what does it mean to have an EMS system and how do we get there? Now, go ahead.
I'll throw something in here that, you know, if you want to get in the Wayback Machine, you know, everything you're talking about I can relate to because I graduated paramedic school in the beginning of 1982. So, yes, I'm dating myself. And I went to Daniel Freeman Hospital paramedic school, and I remember that old Hartmobile, that original concept of EMS was all about heart attacks. And then they got out there and went, oh, my God, people are delivering babies and having strokes and breaking bones. And, oh, my goodness, we might want to rethink this thing. So, and I wanted to throw it to Jamie. How many years have you been doing this, Jamie, as a medic or a nurse?
Oh, boy. Not as long as you'd think, given my age, because I started kind of late. But I think I've got almost 20 years in now.
Yep, and of course, Mr. Kyle is just a puppy, so.
So thanks for bringing that out, and because that's part of, that is actually part of the story, is to say that, you know, so now if you start thinking about the 80s, there's no money, there's no planning and organization, and yet there's this, feeling compelled that we got to do something. Really, everybody was just left to figure it out on their own. Now, in the urban areas where they had a larger tax base and hospitals around, and they got more doctors and resources and thinkers, they kind of figured it out pretty quickly. Although even in the urban areas, a lot of what we were doing is in terms of EMS was really just, well, I think this is a good idea. I mean, think about, and I think all of you that are listening right now would agree with me. Think about the things that you've seen come and go so very quickly in the course of your career. Like Sam, did you have one of the thumpers on your trucks ever?
Oh my God, I hated those things. They were so flipping heavy, and we had to do the two man lift.
Oh, sure.
That thing weighed about 800 pounds, and if you weren't watching it, the next thing you know, it would be something in their belly. So, sure. I mean, the concept was good, but it wasn't very practical. And I actually started right about the time they were getting rid of intracardiac needles, if that tells you anything. How many people would remember that?
So, interestingly, if you look at the clinical things we do, and there's, you know, probably a dozen or more easily things that we could all name between, you know, we got the thumpers, and then it was high dose escalating epi and procardia and hyperventilating head injured patients. You know, the list just goes on and on with things that we thought were a good idea. The interesting thing is on the clinical aspects of it, we did it because it was clinical. You know, there was a lot more research coming along going, hey, you know, that's probably not a great idea. We ought to do something different. But on the system design sort of thing, we didn't have that body of science that was quickly growing, and people were still trying to figure it out based on consensus and what I think is a great idea. And in the rural areas, as they looked around and said, well, who's going to, you know, we're seeing all of this stuff that's coming through about, well, we ought to have ambulance services and EMS, and who's going to do that? The easy solution was, well, we'll just start an ambulance service in our town. And so we'll get me and Jamie and Sam and half a dozen other men and women and whomever's available and ready to volunteer. We'll go buy a truck, and next thing you know, we got an ambulance service overnight. That was literally what happened in many, many parts of rural America. So now that worked back in the 70s and the 80s and even into the 90s. But then to your point, Sam, that you just made, while it really began, we had our genesis in the world of trauma and pulling people off of the highways. The next thing that they figured out was, well, if an ambulance can go to a wreck, well, can they also go to a heart attack or a stroke or, an emergency delivery? And so the demand continued to increase on rural America, just like it did in urban America. It's just that nobody was bringing in the resources. But that's all really kind of superficial. And, what I tell folks now is that there really was something in rural America, there was really something much more sinister going on. Which sinister sounds like a bad word. I don't think that anybody was deliberately meaning to create a crisis. And yet, here we are. So then the next question is, all right, well, what is this crisis of which you speak? Well, it's this. That is that in rural America, that when you're talking about a small town where that ambulance service stood up overnight, and even today, as we sit here and talk to each other, in a town in which an ambulance service maybe runs, you know, maybe 50 calls a year, or 100 calls, or 150, that was being handled by the volunteers through the 70s, 80s, and the 90s, and even today. That's not happening anymore. So now communities are being faced with, as they realize that the volunteers that they do have are aging out of the business. Wyoming has, we have 5 octogenarians who are still licensed in our state. We have about, I don't remember all the numbers. I'm kind of spitballing them to you. I think we have 20 or 30 licensed in the state who are age 70 or better. And then, you know, depending on how far you expand that number, you know, it gets really it can get really kind of crazy. What I tell folks is that within our workforce, that we're looking at in the next, I think it's 5 years, fully 25% of our workforce is either going to retire or is going to hit retirement age of 60. So that's pretty significant. So as the volunteers have aged out and they've gone away, whatever the case might be, the community is looking around and going, wow, we're losing our ambulance service. How can this possibly be? And how did we get into this situation? And gosh, that looks really expensive. It looks like it's going to be really expensive for us to get an ambulance service. To which I now say the response to that is, hey, rural America, it's not that you're waking up today and realizing that EMS is expensive. Well, you are. The truth is that it's been expensive all along. It's just that the volunteers are the ones who have been writing the check. We're in a situation now in rural America where society is finally coming to the realization that we have all benefited for years from the donated labor coming from volunteers. And that is, that's the sinister part of it. The cost has been there. It's just that it's been hidden by the volunteers. We haven't realized it. We haven't paid attention to it. And now the check is coming due, or the dance is ending, whichever way you want to look at it. We've all been enjoying it, but now it's ending.
Well, let me throw a question out to Jamie, because you've been a volunteer for a long time, especially if you've been doing it for 20 years. Have you seen those changes occurring that Andy's talking about in your service?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. And it's a challenge that is seeing whether you're in a rural area where you only run 150 calls, or if you're in an area like mine where you run between 1,500 and 2,000 calls a year. It is becoming increasingly difficult to get the ambulances staffed. Our station has 3 ambulances. We can probably get one out, especially if we have supplemental county paramedics responding, because we can send an ambulance out with just a driver because we have paramedics on the scene already. That's helped a little bit. But the biggest thing we've seen is that the fund we were billing for services through insurance, and the challenge that the fire department's seen that runs our ambulance service is that they were siphoning for years off of the ambulance billing to pay for fire services and equipment. And as we started having to pay or give stipends to people to keep them around so that they'd be available for calls, which really doesn't make them volunteers anymore, but that's a whole nother can of worms. That money went away from the fireside, which built up a whole nother issue. So there's a whole host of things. And it all, as Andy has said, comes down to the fact that EMS is expensive. And when the money is starting to come due, finally.
And Andy, I got a related question to that, but I'm going to throw it out to Kyle in case he has any questions. But he liked your quote so much, he actually wrote it down in the chat room. We'll have to remember that one. Any thoughts, Kyle?
Well, I think it's also important to consider in the discussion of the emergency medical system that ultimately, at the end of the day, no matter how it's evolved over time, it has always started with that call for help to 911. And we cannot forget our first responders, the 911 dispatchers that answer the call and have been over the years increasingly empowered to deliver life-saving medical instructions via the emergency medical dispatch protocols and or other local protocols that they may use within their centers. So it's something that hasn't evolved as fast as I think that it should and that it could. And ultimately, just keeping in mind that with whatever physical responders you have going to the scene, that there's a lot of people behind the scenes that are doing things before that ambulance or that officer ever shows up at your scene.
Very true. And Andy, if you haven't figured it out, he's a 911 dispatcher also. But I have a question that's related. How is you mentioned kind of the shrinking body of volunteers aging out, but how does the aging population affect the whole here?
Yeah, sure. And I don't think that has fully been measured and understood. You know, from my perspective, I really would say that it's only been within the last 3 or 4 years even that we really have been able to get this entire conversation going, not just due to me, but to a whole host of other folks and organizations who are trying to get this word out. And so to your question, I would say, I don't think we really know, but I think that it is absolutely one of the things that that we need some research in, to the same extent that, you know, EMTs and paramedics are easy to get them excited about the next new drug that's along the way or induced hypothermia. Or now we need, I was reading an article about, you know, using ketamine to control, control agitated patients. That stuff that's easy for us to get excited about. But when you look at the things that I'm doing, you have to dig into and get that kind of science and look and say, okay, how is that affecting us? Because I'll throw this into the mix as well, that it's not just the aging population within the volunteer or the EMS workforce. There are some indications that to a certain extent, population in some of our rural areas is actually growing from those who who may be in a demographic where they're looking for, more rural lifestyle, or they are retiring even into some of our rural areas because they want to leave the big city life. So we have an aging population within the workforce. We might have an increasing population in some parts of rural America. And simultaneously, I think it's reflective of a cultural shift that is going on within our small towns.
I was really surprised by one statement in these articles. EMS services deemed essential in only 11 states. That just kind of blew me away. Are you kidding me?
And I would debate even that 11. Because I don't think and this would be EMS industry wide. I throw this down as a challenge to all of my EMS colleagues, be they paramedic, EMT, policymaker, or what have you. I don't think that, first of all, that we all have a common agreement about what it means for EMS to be an essential service. Now, Andy defines that as the state has said to some political subdivision through the mechanism of state law, hey, you, whatever entity you want to put in there, county, city, incorporated area, district, whatever that looks like within your state, you are responsible to ensure that EMS services are available, period. And so I debate even the 11, because I think that there is some determination, you know, some difference about whether or not that has to be provided for, because the backside of a statement like I just laid it out means that in the event that something happens and an EMS or an ambulance service in rural America goes away tomorrow, then somebody is going to step in and pick up that flag and say, okay, well, they're gone, and now here's what we're going to do because it's an essential service. Does that make sense, Sam? I'm not entirely convinced that there's 11 states who have said that.
Yeah, I don't know where that comes from either.
But I think that it is. But I would agree that for the majority of states, as is the case in Wyoming, there is no legal requirement for anybody to make sure that EMS happens. It doesn't reside with my office. It has not been pinned on a county, a hospital, a healthcare district, or whatever the case might be. In Wyoming today, if every ambulance service decided that they were going to fold up, close up shop, sell off their assets, they could do that and just say, nope, no more EMS in this town. And there would be nobody that would be there to pick it up. So.
Wow. Jamie, I'm sure you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, and you know, part of the problem is that the vast majority of the public has no idea how their ambulance is staffed, how their ambulance operates, how it gets paid for. They dial three numbers on their phone and people come to take care of their problem. And so one of the things I constantly see is running into people who have an emergency and surprised when it's their neighbor who shows up. And they sit there and they go, well, I didn't know this is what you did. Yes. Like we're all, you know, when you say, well, we're all volunteers. Really? You know, a lot of times where I live, people have moved out either down from Delaware or up from Baltimore, and they've come from a place that's had a paid EMS system of some sort, that, you know, has paid staff. And so they're surprised that their ambulance comes with volunteers on board that are their neighbors or the grocery store clerk or their mechanic or, you know, you fill in the job here in a small community. And so I think part of our issue in EMS and has been and continues to be that we do a pretty piss poor job of informing our consuming public exactly what we do and how we do it. And until we do that, we can't expect to be considered an essential service. Now, I think we are an essential service. I think if half the EMS agencies folded up in the next 5 years, which, you know, that's not necessarily impossible to have happened, that people will scream bloody murder when they call 911 and are told, well, we're just police and fire now. And I'm curious what Andy thinks about that.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. There's so many things that are going on here. First of all, you were absolutely dead on accurate that the towns, communities, municipalities all remain blissfully ignorant of what's going on and not paying attention. Part of that is due to the fact that in some ways the volunteers have always been there. And as long as the volunteers continue to show up then they don't have to confront the issue. The volunteers themselves, on the flip side of that coin, end up being their own worst enemies in this whole debate for a couple of reasons. One, because why buy the cow if the milk is free? So the fact that they keep showing up just is self, it becomes a self-perpetuating, a self-fulfilling prophecy. In fairness to the volunteers, you know, on for those who have tried to raise awareness and say, hey, we're running out of volunteers and it's getting harder and harder for us to it's getting harder and harder for us to get out and answer ambulance calls. At the same time, there is a portion of the population that still goes because they cannot bear the idea of nobody showing up. So they get caught in this washing machine where you go and, man, somebody stop the world. I want to get off, you know? I for sure admire someone who's in their 80s, literally. I mean, I'm not being flippant when I say that there are people, we have folks out there running ambulance calls right now who are in their 70s and their 80s. God love them for doing it, but also stop. I don't think anybody that's listening to this podcast or participating in it tonight wants to be running ambulance calls when they're in their 70s and 80s. I sure don't. So they're creating their own problem in some ways, but nobody can find a way to break through that.
I hear you. When you can't get in and out of the bus anymore, it's time to call it a day. But, you know, maybe they feel that if they weren't doing it, who's going to? But here's a phrase that kind of sums up what you're saying, Andy, I think. A system that relies exclusively on the goodwill of people is simply unsustainable. EMS agencies need money to recruit and retain qualified workers and for the upkeep of the equipment. When they don't have sufficient funding, they close. That's what you've been saying. But here's another aspect of it. One of the facts I saw was since 2005, 160 rural hospitals have closed. So how is that, again, looking at the big picture?
Yeah, so your question was what as it related to the hospitals?
Yeah, one of the facts in the article was since 2005, 160 rural hospitals have closed. And I assume that means across the country. So it's not only, as a system, it's not just the ambulance services, it's the hospitals. So the ambulance service may be intact, but they have nowhere to take the people.
Sure.
So how does that work in Wyoming specifically?
Sure. So we've been fortunate in that in the 9 years that I've been here, Wyoming has not had a hospital close. On the other hand, we haven't really had a whole lot of hospitals just pop out of nowhere either. In Wyoming, we're talking about 97,000 square land miles, divided up among 23 counties. We have 20, and I use this term broadly, 28 acute care facilities, meaning facilities that have an emergency room open. So that's not all hospitals. It's just facilities because we're mixing a couple of clinics into that mix. But 16 of our hospitals are designated as critical access hospitals. And some of them are, for sure, struggling to continue to find a way to make ends meet. And that, of course, varies from county to county depending on what the particular demographics are in that particular area. But yes, that does put pressure on it, because if you're looking at a volunteer service or even a paid service in rural America, because we really ought to start thinking about this a little bit bigger picture, because this is where I say you start to see this Venn diagram overlapping into even urban America. if you imagine looking at an EMS, a small rural EMS service one day and saying, hey, okay, now we need you to not only pick up the car wrecks, but the heart attacks and the strokes and the diabetics and everything else. Oh, and guess what? Now tomorrow, rather than running out 30 miles and then driving back 30 miles to the local hospital that's there, we now expect you to go 60 miles in one direction, which many, many, many rural services go 60 miles one direction routinely. And for now go do your transport 60 miles, and it's going to be 60 miles till you get back home, and you're probably going to spend an hour doing the paperwork, getting all that wrapped up. And hey, by the way, don't screw that up, because we really need those few dollars that we get from insurance or Medicare. Oh, and hey, by the way, you also need to mop out the truck, make sure everything's reset for the next call. And it's also 3 o'clock in the morning. By the time you get all this done, it's going to be 6, and you got to leave what you're doing and go to your real job, which is actually paying the bills so that you can feed your family. And for that, we're going to pay you the princely sum of exactly nothing. Well, how long would you do that? I mean, if the state of Wyoming came to me, and I shouldn't even say this because I don't want anybody to get crazy ideas. The state of Wyoming came to me and said, hey, Andy, we're going to need you to do what it is that you do, but we're going to need you to do it for free. Well, I'm not going to be here very long. You know what I mean? But that is exactly what society has said to EMS over the years. I don't know who it was, but it was in a GEMS article or EMS World Expo not too long ago. I wish I could remember who had this quote, but I thought it was dead on point as we look at the workforce shortage in EMS across the nation. And the point was that we don't have a workforce shortage. We just have a shortage of people who are willing to do this work for really crappy wages. Now, if you think about that statement and you go, oh, yeah, well, okay. It's, you know, when you're working in a big city and, you know, you're struggling to make ends meet and trying to put bread on the table for your family, and you're making, maybe you're a paramedic and you're making 50 or 60,000, but the firefighter who's managed to get the sweet gig with the paid fire department in town is making 70, 80, 90, 100,000. But you feel like you're going out the door three times as much as they do, you know, you start to look at things through a different filter and go, why am I doing this for the amount of money that I'm getting paid? And then, so that's the overlap into rural and urban and suburban America. And out of all the crappy wages, getting paid nothing is the crappiest of all.
Good, really good point. Kyle, you made a comment in the sidebar here. You want to share that?
Yeah, and just on that notion of transport times, I know there are many more extreme examples from my time at the Weiss Medical Campus with my Knowles education up in Wyoming for just extended transport times and things. But locally where I work in Aspen, our ambulances will routinely, for very critical patients, if we can't fly them, they'll drive 130 miles one way for trauma and some cardiac patients to the level one trauma center down here on the western slope of Colorado. So even some of our more, you know, typical urban systems will still have to transport out. We just don't have the capabilities in some of our more rural facilities.
Andy, I got two more questions for you.
Sure.
Being as this is called the Disaster Podcast, I assume that all of this also has an effect on disaster when you need extra people, extra trained people, correct?
Oh, without a doubt. You know, and so this is often the connection that I make on this. And some years ago, I had the opportunity to participate in basically kind of an assessment of EMS as in disaster preparedness. Sat on a panel with several others with my then my good friend Tom Nearing, who was my counterpart in North Dakota but has sadly passed away. Another strong advocate for rural EMS and a mentor of mine. But anyway, Tom and I had the chance to sit on this panel to kind of help evaluate, you know, how has EMS progressed since 9/11? And as Tom and I sat in on that discussion and we listened to things, you know, there was all this discussion about EMS needs to be, you know, they need to be going through the routine exercise of, you know, planning and then tabletop and then a functional and then a full scale exercise. And we need this, and we need that. And we got to have, you know, now we got to train them to be ready for, to be handled an Ebola outbreak and other highly infectious diseases. And Tom and I looked at each other in the panel around the room and said, you know, this is all great, good, and wonderful, and I hope y'all figure it out. Well, we're coming out of states where we're wondering whether or not there's going to be an ambulance service there in the first place. So I think the thing, you know, for the particular audience that this, that you guys try to reach with what you're doing here, I think the thing to understand here is, I don't care where you are. It is my opinion that as go your day-to-day EMS operations, so goes your disaster response. And I think you guys would agree with me. You know, if you can't, if you don't know how to adapt and adjust in your day-to-day operations, move trucks around, flex up, flex down, get extra people in, respond to the mass casualty incident. If you fail at that, you're absolutely going to fail when the big one hits, whatever the big one happens to be. So now if you think about rural America, and there's nobody there to begin with, and who's watching out for these, I think it starts to become pretty dire. You know, you could certainly look at, you know, a mass casualty incident, a bus wreck, go look at the Mexican Hat, bus wreck sometime and see what went on out there. A bus wreck, a plane crash, whatever, a multi-vehicle accident. Sure, that's one scale where you're going to have a difficult response. But think about something that's even more slow developing, insidious, like pandemic flu that's breaking loose through the rural parts of America. Boy, you want to talk about stressing a healthcare system in a hurry. Have a small town with three volunteer EMTs and a small ED and two beds, and suddenly they realize that they've got 30 people in that ED, all of whom are showing signs and symptoms of pandemic flu. So that's why I say, you know, it's not just – yes, it is about the day-to-day answer a heart attack and a stroke. But if you look the repercussions of failing to address this long-term, when that next big thing hits, could be absolutely disastrous. Because nobody's going to be there.
You're scaring me, Andy. So last question, and I want to get Jamie's thoughts on this. What do we do about it? What can we do about it? Or are we just going to have to suck it up and deal with what is?
Well, did you want to let Jamie answer that first? Or do you want me to take off on it?
Why don't you take it, Andy? Because I honestly have no answer. I mean, I've said for years that I think education is the first part of the answer for a lot of things, because until our public understands how we operate, they can't be expected to understand why they have to pay more for it. That's part of the problem. I also think that EMS has no business being part of a first responder community. It should be part of the local healthcare system. But, you know, that's preaching to the choir in a lot of places, because, like I said, fire departments get a lot of money out of EMS, and they like the fact that they can bill for those services, because they can't bill for fire suppression.
Sure. And I agree with you, Jamie, that that education is a big part of this, because I think for too long we have not been – we're not telling the right story, or we're telling it in the wrong way. Because on the surface, when you're looking at rural America, it seems like this issue is about volunteers. But down deep underneath, it's not about volunteers. It's about how we as a society think about, envision, plan for, design, build EMS systems. Think about all of that history that I started out with, saying this is how we got here. So the answer to the question is not How do we find more volunteers? In a way, it's not even how do we pay for it or how do we suddenly come up with a bunch of money. No, the conversation that has to happen across the United States on EMS is, what does it mean? What are the elements of EMS system design? How do we get that in there? What can we pay for? What can we not? How do we need to make it flow better? So that's the real conversation that we have to have. So in that, to your point about education, is understanding what has actually been going on. EMS has always been expensive. It's just that the volunteers have been writing the check. So the fat man's been busy dancing while the thin man pays the band. That's exactly what we've had going on. We never planned for it. It's unrealistic to expect that that will continue in the future, nor should we, because in planning for an everyday event or a disaster, it's not a plan to just say, oh, a lot of really good-hearted people are going to show up, although they often do. That's not a plan. A plan says, this is the resources that we're going to have, and we're going to marshal and how we're going to organize them. And that's what we need to do. It's about a culture change within EMS in rural America. You know, when in small town America, when these ambulance services begin to kind of fracture and feel like they're riding on the edge, there is a deep, deep sense of loss that gets attached with that. I often talk about, and I can show you, I have it mapped out, kind of the, you can literally see the seven stages of grieving in a small town as they begin to confront this problem. So there's part of me that just says, man, we need to rip this Band-Aid off, get over the heartache in rural America over what used to be, and start thinking about what the future looks like. In small town America, if you're on that ambulance, that's your heart and soul. It's not just about that's an ambulance service. It's about it's my ambulance service. And I'm not just Andy. I'm not just Andy, the guy who happens to work at the mill or who happens to work at the local gas station. I'm Andy, the EMS boss. And so the first reaction to that among EMS folks in rural America, the first reaction to that is, well, gosh, you're suggesting that this needs to change. And what that means is that I'm no longer important and that my town is no longer important and my ambulance is no longer important. No, that's not true. You are important. It's just that we have to begin to build something else. Your identity is still your Andy or Joe or Jane, the EMT or paramedic or whatever it is in that town. It's just that we have to be proactive as community to plan for the future. So I think that that is what has to happen. That big conversation that involves education and understanding what's going on, et cetera, has to get going. Number two, what we absolutely need is it's not hard science. It's in the way that they measure physics and math and chemistry and the rest of that, but it is absolutely soft science in figuring out what exactly is going on, and what are the pressures and how do we build that. And then number three, it's building and defining those transitional models that help communities move from what they have now into something different. And it probably is going to look very different and should look very different. Aggregating resources, taking regional approach, realizing that, you know, the truth of the matter is that not every small town of 150 people or 200 needs an ambulance service. There are ways to save lives without that go beyond having an ambulance service in that town. So that's all a really big gumbo of things that has to be stirred up and pulled apart. And there's so many elements that are in there. But I do think that the first step is the sort of thing that we're doing here tonight, to say, hey, look, this is a problem. Let's get educated. Let's talk about it. And let's think about how we design and build EMS between now and the year 2050.
Oh, I totally agree. And I think we've just dipped our toes in that water. And I think we need to have more conversations with you about this. And one thing I love about Kyle is he seems to learn something new from every guest. You have gobsmacked him. I mean, he's been in EMS quite a while and differing sides of it. And he couldn't believe what he was hearing from you. So we definitely need to continue this conversation. Jamie, I'm going to throw it back to you for final thoughts and comments, and I think you'd agree we need to have Andy back.
I absolutely think we need to have Andy back, and I think this is a conversation that, you know, it's not a new conversation. You know, I've had similar conversations with Chris Montero and in the EMS Garage 15 years ago when he and I were on that show, or on the Medicast when we were doing the live shows at EMS World. Or at EMS Today, we've had this conversation several times before to talk about all sorts of things dealing with, you know, dealing with what it means to be a professional in EMS and what it means to take the EMS system to the next step. And I think Andy points out quite well that we never really planned for it to be a system to begin with the way it should have been. And I think that's probably a good starting point for the next conversation too. But I think that, you know, in the meantime, we've got to train and we've got to do the things we need to do for education when we have the budget to do so. And, so we want to thank, just thank our sponsors, Paragon Medical Education Group. Joe couldn't be here with us tonight. You know, they try as best they can, you know, with the resources that people have for training and such, that they can come in and give you an opportunity to train on a budget and work with you and customize the type of training they bring in. So if you're looking for some sort of disaster preparedness training that's different and experiential, I would recommend reaching out to Paragon Medical Group. You can find them at paragonmedicalgroup.com, also at paragonmededu on Twitter. And, of course, there are links over at disasterpodcast.com and in our Facebook group for the Disaster Podcast. And so we want to thank them again for their continued support so we can have these kind of discussions. Andy, thank you very much for taking the time to come on with us tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me on. You know, I'm just one voice among many, and there's lots of folks that have been out there talking about it. Sam, I'm right up the road from you, so come on up and say howdy. And you know, I'm happy to help out whatever way. Thank you guys so much for doing what you do to promote EMS in all sorts of ways. So yeah, glad to do it.
Thank you. Thank you.
I will take you on that.
Definitely. Kyle, where can folks find you if they want to catch what you're talking about online?
Well, Jimmy, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WXKyleNelson. I'm also in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group.
Sam, how about you?
Well, pretty much where you find Kyle, social media under Sam Bradley, SamBradley11 on DisasterPodcast.com website, and certainly in the podcast group, which I think they were the ones that actually requested this topic, so they're quite excited about hearing this. And Andy, if you're not a member, we'd love to have you as one, because that way they can address questions to you directly. So, and is there another place we should look for you or this topic?
You can find me in the Disaster Podcast group on Facebook. I went in and liked that, and so I think I'm in there just now today. You know, certainly you can find me. With a Google search, you can find my Wyoming email address. I'm always happy to answer questions and help anyone out. So you can hit me with an email, find my office number, my email address, andy.ginapp@wyo.gov. So first name dot last name at wyo.gov. Happy to help out. And just, again, thank you so much for having me on.
It's definitely a pleasure to have you on, and we do appreciate you taking the time on a Friday night. We're recording on Friday this week just because all the holidays and everything else going on this time of year is making it challenging to get everybody together, so we appreciate you taking some of your Friday for us. Sam, you know, this is a great look at a difficult topic that I don't think is going to go away anytime soon, and something that I think we need to keep clear and be talking about and having that discussion on a more regular basis, and not just within our own closed community, because I think that's part of the problem. We need to have this discussion publicly and educate our public and our lawmakers and our policymakers exactly what's going on so that they can be prepared for what's going to start happening with increasing frequency, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. And hopefully our community will take this and run with it, even internationally. It'd be interesting to see how other countries are dealing with this or if they're running into the same issues, and I bet they are. But I guess we could say about this one, rural EMS is not our everyday EMS.